Let's see. It's working. Today's topic is the continuation of last week's public key, but now we are concentrating on another difficult mathematical problem, and that's factoring of large integers. So, you have already noticed that unlike the symmetric ciphers, we studied actually the cryptanalysis before the very crypto systems. So, the cryptanalysis is actually solving the difficult mathematical problem. So, last time we first explained how to solve discrete log. Of course, it will not work for large fields. And here we first show how to solve the integer factorization problem. Of course, it will not work for large integers. That's why we use crypto systems based on these hard problems in practice. Okay, so let's say something about the problem by itself. So we actually announced that, and most of you have already met that, because RSA, the system that is used most often, you have already met, and you use it every day in your browsers, etc., etc. So what is our integer factorization problem? So given a positive integer n, that can be composite, write n as a product of prime factors, and each prime factors may be repeated. So this power alpha something, that's actually how many times this factor is repeated in the factorization. And of course, these p's are different. They're all different. So pairwise distinct primes. And each alpha, each power is greater than or equal to 1. If it is 1, we just don't write it, but yeah. So you know from primary school that any number can be written in this form, and you know you have learned in primary school how to factor small numbers. So just by trial and error, we are going to mention that today. For example, say that we want to factor the number 30. So we start with the smallest prime, which is 2. If we can divide by 2, then we write the quotient, and then we try again. If not, then we try the next one, which is 3. Okay, then the next one, which is 5, until we get 1. So it is 2 times 3 times 5. So this is the primary school method. It will, of course, not work for very large integers, but everybody knows that. Now, this problem is actually, we discussed that last week, it is in NP, but it is suspected not to be NP complete, which means it is not one of the hardest problems. Not every NP problem can be reduced to that one. That's the idea. However, this has not been proved. We don't know. But it's people that study this problem, they suspect that it is not in NP complete. Which means it may happen with this problem the same as has happened with the problem P. So given an integer, is it a prime? So it has been proved in 2002 that this problem is not NP complete, it is actually in P. So there is a polynomial time algorithm to solve that problem. Of course, that's just in theory, because this polynomial is of very high degree and this algorithm is not practical. However, it is deterministic algorithm by which we can test whether a given number is a prime, and it is bounded by a polynomial. So formally, it's a polynomial time algorithm. Yeah. So, for now, for the integer factorization problem, we don't know. So no polynomial time algorithms are known to solve this IFP problem, integer factorization problem. However, since it is not in NP complete, and even if it were, we don't know whether P is equal to NP. If P is equal to NP, then all the older problems have easy algorithms. So We don't know two things. We don't know whether IFP is NP complete, which would increase the probability of this problem being very difficult, really, in theory. And we don't know whether P is equal to NP, which actually destroys all cryptography. So for now, we say that IFP is suspected not to be the most difficult possible. Now, regarding the practical solution of the problem, the best known algorithms run in sub-exponential time. They are actually probabilistic in nature, which means that they may not produce the result. And the second, running times, how long it will run, given any integer, it's not proved that it will be always the same. So that's, we are not going into details, because that would be a whole semester of this. IFP has been studied very extensively, because this problem is very important. Now, regarding the algorithms that are used in practice, there are two categories of them. First, last time when we talked about discrete log, we actually studied the general purpose algorithms that would work for any field. Now we are doing the opposite. So general purpose algorithms whose running time depends solely on the size of the given number, like quadratic sieve and especially the number field sieve algorithm, they are actually the best. And they work for any n. However, they are very complicated to implement, to study, etc., etc., because of that we are not going to concentrate on them. These algorithms have two phases. First is called data collection, where we first need to collect some intermediate values. And then we use them in this data processing phase. Now, why are these algorithms important, even though we are not going to concentrate on them? They are important because the best results in solving the integer factorization problems have been achieved with these algorithms. Now, what we are going to concentrate on is these special purpose algorithms. They perform better when the integer being factored is somehow special. For example, and that's typical for RSA, where we have two factors that are close to each other by size. So sometimes this can be used to make the factorization easier, like in this Fermat's factorization. Now, Poisson-Drouin algorithm may work well. It's a probabilistic algorithm, you will see. But it may fail miserably as well. And, of course, trial division, that's this. So, as we said, the general purpose algorithms are complicated to implement. There are papers where it is explained how to implement this, for example, on Cray, etc., etc. So, well, you were probably not born at that time when it was done, but that was in 1980s, early 1990s, when these algorithms have been defined, and it was a breakthrough because the best results were achieved with them. However, it was possible on special computers, special implementation methods, etc., etc. And regarding the time and space complexity, it's very difficult to analyze precisely. Which means we may factor a 1,000-digit number with this, but it will not guaranteed that the next 1,000-digit number will be factored as easily as that one. You know? And it has happened many times. So you will find in the literature, yes, we have factored a number that is 2 pages long, for example. So it's a lot of bits. However, it only holds for this number, not for another number of the same size. And we don't know what will happen if we take another number. So it may take forever to factor this. But they have been successful in factoring. The known factorization of the largest numbers so far have been obtained by means of the algorithms from this group, especially the number field sieve algorithm, this one by Leenstra. But that's 30 years old. And every now and then there is a small advance in this factoring, and the problem is interesting because most public key is based on RSA, and RSA is based on this problem. So if you manage to factor to solve this problem in general, then all the banking will fail immediately. So internet banking, all this, and many other things. And regarding the special purpose algorithms, they are good enough for solving this problem up to 50 digits, which is nothing, it's not useful for cryptography, because in cryptography we use numbers that are much larger than this. However, we are going to explain some of these algorithms, because in special cases they may function for RSA. Regarding trial division, well, you don't need the explanation. So use a table of prime numbers up to certain, of course, small size, because n is also small. Divide with the smallest prime and then do it as you can. So as long as we can, because it may be 2 to the power of something in this factorization. And then take the next one, etc., etc., until you get 1 as the quotient. This is, of course, too slow. It will not work for large n. It will work, but forever. It will not give you result during your whole life if you take 1,000 digits and try this. So, no way of doing this for cryptographically interesting numbers. Now, regarding Fermat's factorization, this is interesting, because the RSA, as you are going to see, you probably know this, but we are going to go into details of RSA, and you know that there we use 2 large primes, and we multiply them, and we get a composite that contains 2 factors, P and Q. We call them P and Q, or A and B, or whatever. They are close in size. Actually, it's a requirement, and you can try for homework what happens, and you will find that on the net. What happens if you use P and Q that are not of the same size? For example, if Q is much bigger than P or P is much bigger than Q, you will see that in that case you can factor easily. And factoring actually breaks the system. So it's a requirement in RSA that P and Q, the 2 numbers, 2 primes that are used, are of the same size in bits. So suppose that N is A times B, where A and B are close together. Then AB, well, you use some tricks. You write AB as this minus this. Okay? Now, obviously, this is AB. So A squared divided by 4 minus A squared divided by 4, that's 0. B squared divided by 4 minus B squared divided by 4, that's 0. And then AB divided by 2 plus AB divided by 2, it's obviously AB. So this is correct. Now, this is a trick because, well, the Norwegians, only one here, so this is actually what is called in Norwegian første kvadratsetting, and this one is andre kvadratsetting, and this one is tredje kvadratsetting. So that's something that is taught in secondary school. So a plus b square is a square plus 2ab plus b square. So that's what we call første kvadratsetting. And then you have minus, then it will be a square minus 2ab plus b square, etc., etc. So this here is actually a half plus b half square. And this here is a half minus b half square. Now, this, and you have minus here, and they are both square. So that's, if you call this t and this s, then it's t square minus s square, which is t plus s times t minus s. That's what we call tredje kvadratsetting in Norwegian. I don't know in English how we call it. Well, anyway, this is known from the secondary school. You know this. So t square minus s square, that's t plus s times t minus s. Now, this gives you a possibility to factor n, because what if t and s are close together? Well, a and b are close together, then s is small. That's the idea. Now, t will only be small, slightly greater than square root of n. And then we start by square root of n. Well, the closest integer to it. And try. We start with this one, and compute t square minus n. Okay, so from this, if n is t square minus s square, then s square is t square minus n. So, start with square root of n, and then compute this. It will be t. Then t square minus n, and check whether it is a perfect square. If yes, then we have found the factorization. So, well, this may sound complicated, but on an example you will see what I mean. So n is something like this, 200,890, so a big number. And then square root is 448, which means 449. So we start with 449, and t square, so t is 449. T square minus the given number n will give 782, which is not a square. So because if you try 782, square root of that, it is not the whole number, so we have to try another one. So we try the next one, which is 450. Now 450 square minus the given number, it's 1681, which is 41 square, which means our n is 450, which is t, plus s, 41, times t minus s, which is 491 times 409. So we have found the factors a and b. Now, in general, of course, these two numbers do not have to be prime. However, in RSA, it will be, because they have two prime factors only. Now, if you have more than that, some of these may be composite, then you just continue using the same method. So the factors computed are not necessarily prime. And you will find today in our exercise that if you put some number that has more factors, then you will have to factor further. So you repeat the procedure for each factor until one of the computed factors is 1. The other one must be prime. So then we have found the prime factor, and if you have many prime factors, then you do the same for all the discovered factors by maintaining a queue. So that's technically how we do it in programming. So, but anyway, once you find two factors, then you have solved the integer factorization problem, because this number may be large, but these two will be smaller. And because of that, it will be easier to factor them if they are composite. So the system based on this number, 200,819, will be broken easily, because it is, you see, even though it's large, it's small for cryptography, if you want to base RSA on this. Now, why cannot we break RSA with this? Because it's still too slow. It works well if n is a product of two primes, p and q, that are extremely close together, but, which is the case in RSA. However, it takes this number of steps to find the factorization, p minus q absolute value divided by 2. Now, how big is this number? If p and q are of the size 100 digits, it's likely that the difference is also 100-digit integers, so you will never finish with this. So that's the problem. So it's still too slow. However, it's better than this one. Now, probabilistic algorithm, like Pollard's row algorithm, it may be good, but it may fail. That's the problem. It makes use of what we call in probability birthday paradox. Now, there are many interpretational birthday paradox. Of course, it's called birthday, because if you have some n persons in the room, what is the probability that two of them share the same birthday? You know? And it turns out that this probability is actually high. Now, we interpreted it differently in the number theory. Among k numbers generated at random, what is the probability that their difference of two numbers taken from this k divides the given number n? Okay? Now, it turns out that this probability is 1 divided by square root of n. And how can we check that? Okay, now if we find two numbers whose difference divides n, then we have obviously factored n, because this difference will be a factor. Now, we can of course check by taking two numbers at random, computing the difference and checking whether they divide n. But that's trying pairwise. So if you have k numbers and k is large, then it's k times k minus 1 divided by 2. So that's a big number. Okay? Too much memory would be used for that. But what we can do is generate these numbers in some sequence. And this sequence is pseudo-random. And then we try the current one against the previous one. So we do it in some sequential way, not just take two at random, which we could do as well. But it would not be very practical. And if we do this, then we make the algorithm more practical. And that's actually used in Pollard's row algorithm. Now, what's the problem? The problem is this. We have met that when we talked about stream ciphers, interestingly enough, when we talked about sequences from feedback shift registers, if you remember. So a sequence may have an aperiodic start. And then after this point, it will move in a cycle. Now here you will have, as you're going to see, the same things. But first, let's explain what is Pollard's row algorithm. So if P is an unknown factor of N, and this factor, as in Fermat's factorization case, it is not necessarily a prime. But once you find the factor that is prime or not prime, then you have solved the problem, because the problem is of factoring a big number, not of factoring a smaller number. So once you factor a big number, then the rest is easy. So let P be some factor of N. And then we choose some iteration function, Zn to Zn. So these are numbers modulo N, okay, integers modulo N. And starting value, some seed, x0, which is from Zn. And then we recursively define xi as f of xi minus 1. So we said we use a pseudo-random sequence. So we have a number and the previous number from that sequence. So that's this. So xi is f of xi minus 1 for all I greater than 0. Then we have a sequence of pseudo-random numbers, xi. I goes from 1, 2, etc., etc., as long as we want. Now, this sequence is, as we said, ultimately periodic. So that's interesting. That's why the algorithm is called row, because this is a Greek row. So this sequence is ultimately periodic, which means it has an aperiodic start, and after some point it becomes periodic, because once we go through the whole period, then we never go back here. So we just continue in this cycle forever. So once the sequence gets into the periodic part, the search continues forever without finding a factor. Now, in the stream cipher case, we want it to be on this cycle. In this case, we don't want to be on this cycle. So because once we find ourselves in this point again, the same numbers will be repeated, and we have already checked that none of them is a factor. So we shall never solve the problem. So that's why Pollard's row algorithm may fail. So it's a probabilistic algorithm. Now, how do we know that we have reached the initial point of this cycle? We need what is called cycle detection algorithm. We can find or detect a cycle in several ways, and the most often used one is the Floyd's cycle detection algorithm, where instead of one pseudorandom sequence of this kind, we use two pseudorandom sequences. Actually, it's the same pseudorandom sequence, but one goes at double speed. So both sequences start from the same point, which is initial value, x0, etc., etc. And then one sequence is generated at double speed So it's not f of x, it's f of x, or y, or whatever. Now, why this? Because sooner or later, you will find the collision. So both sequences will give the same value, will have the same value, and once a collision is found, we have a cycle. So we have to abort this search. This is one that is very often used, Floyd's cycle detection algorithm. There are others. So we'll find in the literature like Brent, this is newer, from 1980. And there are others. So what is the algorithm? How do we do this? The mapping is often x squared plus 1. This is empirical result. So nobody says why this function, why not some other function. We know that x plus 1 doesn't work, so it will not be very good. But square works in many cases. And then x0 is a seed, some random integer in this Zn, so arithmetic modulo the given number. Now y0 and x0 are the same. So both certain random sequences, they both start at the same point. And then in this loop, we iterate. So we compute the next value of one sequence, the slower one. Xi is f of xi minus 1, modulo n. And the second one is actually at double speed. Yi is f of yi minus 1. So in the beginning, they're the same. So this will go twice as fast. Now, what are the cases regarding xi and yi? They may be such that xi minus yi, remember, we are investigating the difference between two randomly chosen numbers and whether this difference divides n. Okay? So what can happen with this difference? So it may divide n, which means the difference and n, they have a common factor which is neither 1 nor n. So this factor is actually what we need. So that's the favorable result. Now, the worst option is this. If the difference and n have the common factor that is n, then we have reached this. So we have to stop the search and try with some other x and y. And the third case, which is not listed here, that's the only that remains, is that this gives 1, so these two are mutually prime. In which case, we just repeat the procedure. So three possibilities. One is that these two, the difference x minus y, and n, they are not mutually prime, and the factor is not n. Then we have found the factor of n. The factor will be this. The greatest common divisor of these two. It will be the factor. The second possibility is when the greatest common divisor is n. That means that we have to try the new seed and repeat the procedure because we have found the cycle. So once you get into a cycle, you will not find the result, obviously, because these values will repeat forever. And the third one is when the factor is actually 1, the common factor, which means that we haven't found the factor yet, but we are not in the loop yet. So we have not entered this point yet. So this Poisson algorithm may be very, very successful for some cases, but of course it may fail. Now if n is very large, we can of course try many of these initial values, but the number of possibilities is so large that we may very often get into this trap failure, and we shall have to try extremely many x's, x0s, and y0s, and because of that it will not solve our factoring of very large integer problem. Now, for a small integer, it of course works, and we illustrate the algorithm on this example. N is 91. We know that it is 7 times 13, but let's detect it. So we use the standard function, f of x is x squared plus 1, and we start with the seed 1, which is typical, and then by the algorithm. First of all, x0 is 1, y0 is 1, and then the next x is x squared plus 1. Yeah? So 1 squared plus 1, that's 2. And next y is 1 squared plus 1, and then square, and then plus 1. So it goes at double speed. So that's exactly this one, so it is 5. And then what is 2 minus 5? That's minus 3, but minus 3 modulo 91, that's 88. So just add 91. Of course, minus 3 and 88, that's the same, because the arithmetic is modulo 91, and the negative numbers are not very, let's say, programmable in this case, because you will have to run the Euclidean algorithm to find the factor, the common factor of 88 and 91. In this case, it is 1, so we have to continue, but we haven't found the cycle yet. So we generate the next x, which is the previous one, which was 2 squared plus 1, that's 5, and the previous y was 5, so we have 5 squared plus 1, and then square, and then plus 1. That's 6, 7, 7. Modulo 91, that's 40. Now, 5 minus 40, this one minus this one, that's minus 35, plus 91, that's 56. Now, 56 and 91, if you run Euclidean algorithm, you can do it at home, you will find that the common factor is 7. So 7 is a factor of 91. And divide 91 by 7, you will get 13. So these are the factors. And obviously, both 7 and 13 are primes. It doesn't have to be so. If there are more factors, then some of these two that we find here will not be a prime. This is how you can break a system that whose security is based on the impossibility of factoring large integers in practice. Now let's define such a system. You have all heard about this RSA in 1978, Rives, Shamir and Adleman, these are the authors, they proposed the public key crypto system, and you have the original paper in our Blackboard doc section. The security is based on the difficulty of factoring large integers. It's most often used in practice. Why is that? Because it's relatively easy to implement. And it offers security that is not worse than, for example, of discrete log. So these problems, as we said, are of the same kind. They lie in NP. They are suspected not to be NP complete, but nobody has proved that. So we don't know. They may be hard. So, in addition to this, as you are going to see when we talk about digital signatures in 2 weeks, you will see that it's very easy to implement digital signatures with this. With ElGamal, it's a bit more complicated, so it will take more operations for the same security. So, digital signatures are easy to implement with RSA. It's the same operation as you are going to see. Now, if the size of the primes used in system, RSA, is approximately 2048 bits with today's technology, well, 2023 technology. It has not advanced that much since 2021. So it is acceptable security provided we don't have this quantum computer. So a quantum computer will break all this, as they say, but so far our quantum computers are not that good to break 2048-bit numbers, to factor them. So how does this work? Each participant does the following, and everybody knows this. Generates two large distinct random primes, P and Q, of approximately same size, if encoded in bits. As we said, and for homework, try if P is much smaller than Q, how to break this. You will see that it's easy. You find it on the net. Now, each participant computes n equal to pq. So it will be one part of his or her public key. And for private use, they compute phi of n is p minus 1 q minus 1. Why is phi of n, which is Euler's function, that's the number of integers that are smaller than n and mutually prime with n. Why do you know that phi of n is p minus 1 times q minus 1? Because p and q are of multiplicity 1 each, and we have already seen this formula. It is pi to the power of this factor minus pi to the power of this factor minus 1, and for each factor, which means if the factor the power of the factor, if multiplicity of the factor is 1, then this is 1 and this is 0. So pi to 0, this is this one here. So p minus 1 times q minus 1, that's the value of the Euler function of n. Now the participants, they of course know the factorization of n, because they generate the factors. Then each participant selects a random integer e between 1 and phi of n, such that e is mutually prime to phi of n. Why mutually prime to phi of n? Because what we need is a multiplicative inverse of e modulo phi of n. And that's this d. So d is between 1 and phi of n, such that ed is 1 modulo phi of n. How do we get d? We need extended Euclidean algorithm. And d is the multiplicative inverse of e modulo phi of n. If e is not mutually prime with phi of n, then it doesn't have multiplicative inverse. What is the public key? The public key is the pair n and e. And the private key is d. So e is used for encipherment, and encipherment in RSA is powering modulo n. And d is used for decipherment, which is also a power of modulo n. E and d are large numbers in general. Because of that, for powering we need our modular exponentiation. So last time we talked about modular exponentiation and extended Euclidean algorithm. These are two things that are necessary to use in any of these public key systems, so you have to learn them very well. We are going to use them all the time. In addition, they will be used in elliptic curves as well, which is our next week's topic. So, how does Alice enciphers a message for Bob? She obtains Bob's public key, NB and EB, but authentic. So the problem with the system is that you have to authenticate the other party, as the same thing as we had to do with Diffie-Hellman. So it's easy to present yourself as Bob if there is no authentication. Then you get the message. So that's compulsory to avoid. Because of that, you first authenticate Bob. But that's not a part of the system, RSA. So we assume that Bob is Bob. Okay? We are sure that Bob is Bob. So we take NB and EB from some phone book, public directory. Now, Alice represents her message in the form of an integer m, and this m, of course, has to be smaller than NB minus 1, than NB, okay? So it will be on the segment. Segment means included the limits. So 0 is included, NB minus 1 is included, but not NB. Because the powering is done modulo NB. So if the message is NB, then NB the result will be 0. Okay? So Alice computes the ciphertext, which is the message to the power of EB modulo NB. That's easy to do because we know modular exponentiation. So that's easy to do even though EB is large. And then Alice sends C to Bob. How does Bob decipher? He uses his private key, DB, to compute M, which is C to DB modulo NB, and then M is converted into meaningful text. Now, how do we know that M is C to DB modulo NB? So we have received the ciphertext, and we know that by powering by DB, to the power of DB modulo NB, we get the message. Well, that's the proof here. So we use one of many Euler's theorems, and this particular one is something like this. If M and NB, if they are mutually prime, then M to the power of phi of NB is 1, modulo NB. So we are going to exploit this theorem. So what do we know? We know that P and Q are large primes, so M probably has neither P nor Q as a factor, because M is actually chosen at random. We can say that M can be anything. So in theory, M could be divisible by P or Q. Now, the probability of that is, of course, extremely small, and it can be shown that even if M and NB are not mutually prime, that the decipherment works. But we are not going to concentrate on that. We are going to concentrate on a typical case where M is a normal thing, which means P or Q do not divide M. Now, DB is the multiplicative inverse of EB, which means E times D is 1. Modulo phi of NB. Now, if this holds, then we can also say that EBDB is something times phi of NB plus 1, because when you divide by phi of NB, this disappears. Okay, so this here, the whole expression, EBDB is K times phi of NB plus 1. If you take both sides modulo phi of NB, then you get this. Obviously, this will disappear. Now, K can be any integer. So 1, 2, 3, whatever. So what we have is C to the power of DB. We are deciphering. So C to the power of DB, what is C? C is M to EB. That's what Alice did. And Bob, he raises to the power of DB, modulo NB. Okay? Now, this is obviously M to EBDB, modulo NB. And then what is EBDB? EBDB is written in this way. Okay, so we can write it as K times phi of NB plus 1. And this is what we do. Okay, modulo NB. And then we transform this a bit. So M to the power of K times phi of NB plus 1, that's M times M to phi of NB to the power of K, obviously. Because here you have to the power of plus 1, which means this is M times this, and then this can be written as power of power. So M to phi of NB to the power of K, because this is K times phi to the power phi of NB. Okay? Now we use the Euler's theorem, this one. So M to phi of NB is 1, modulo NB, which means we have 1 to K, which means we have M. So we obtained the message by powering C to the power of DB. So that was the proof that we know that by powering C to the power of the private key, we get the message. So this is, of course, elaborated much wider in the original paper. So the proof is there. So we know that RSA works. Now, how secure is RSA? The security lies in the belief that the encipherment function is a one-way function. So inverting this function is computationally difficult. Now, if somebody knows the trapdoor, which is the factoring of N, then you can decipher. And that's only Bob, because only Bob has DB. If cryptanalyst can find D, then she can probably find the factors of N and consequently phi of N. And for homework, you can actually try that. So suppose that you know phi of N. So you will see that you break the system very easily. Let's have a break.
Ça a l'air que l'ordinateur, j'ai couvert, c'est sûr. Vendredi, j'ai couvert. Genre le fait de tenir comme ça, c'est
Let's look at an example of RSA with very small numbers. So say that Bob wants to define his parameters for this RSA. He chooses two numbers that are of the same size. So 11 and 13, they can both be encoded in 4 bits, obviously. So 11 is 1011 and 13 is 1101. Now, he computes NB, which is 11 times 13, which is 143. And phi of NB will be P minus 1 times Q minus 1. It will be 10 times 12, which is 120. Now, he chooses the second part of his public key. EB will be, say, 7. Now, if you choose a prime number, then this number and this number will, in 99.99% of the cases, will be mutually prime, unless it happens that this is a multiple of E, which is not very, very likely. So E doesn't have to be a prime. What is required is that E and this phi of N are mutually prime, because if they are mutually prime, then in the group modulo phi of N, E will have an inverse. If you remember when we talked about groups, we said that only invertible elements are only those that are mutually prime with the modulus. So in this case, this holds, because 7 is a prime. Now, we have to check whether it holds. Of course, we know that because 7 is a prime and 120 is not a multiple of 7. Now, how do we know, how do we get D, the inverse of E? We use extended Euclidean algorithm. Okay, so Euclidean algorithm will give us 120 is 17 times 7 plus 1, and we go the other way around. So we say that 1 is 120 minus 17 times 7. Take both sides modulo 120, this will disappear. So 1 is equal to minus 17 times 7, modulo 120. Which means if we don't like negative numbers, we just add 120. And that will be 103. So 103 is an inverse of 7 modulo 120. And that's easily checked. We say 103 times 7 modulo 120. That must be 1. So that's true. So Bob's secret key is 103, so he will not transmit this D by any means. And Bob posts his public key, which is P times Q, which is 143 and 7, E equals to 7, in some public repository like a phone book, and he keeps D equal to 103 secret. So Bob has done his job. Now Alice wants to send the message 5 and cipher by means of RSA to Bob. So what she does is, okay, finding Bob's public key. So she finds Bob's public key in some public directory. And then she computes the ciphertext. It will be the plain text to the power of E, which is 7, modulo N. 143. So this is NBEB. So I don't have to state these indexes all the time. So N and E. And how does she do it? She can do it by using modular exponentiation, because this E can be large. Of course, in this case, 5 to 7 modulo 143 can be computed on a calculator, but we don't want to do that. We want to practice modular exponentiation. So what is the binary representation of the exponent? It's 111. Okay? So if it is 111, wherever if we have 11, we put an asterisk, which means all these will be used in the computation. Now, M5 to the power of 2 to the power of I modulo N. So the first one will be always 5, because 2 to the power of 0 is 1. So 5 to 1, and then the next one square, of course, modulo 143, And then in the end, you multiply all these elements of the table that have asterisks here, and they are all in this case because the binary representation of the exponent is or was. So that's easy. So C will be 5 times 25 times 53. So these three numbers multiplied, and that's 47 modulo 143. So the ciphertext is 47. How does Bob decipher? Well, he raises 47, the ciphertext, to the power of his secret key, 103. Now, what is 103? It is 1100111. How do I know that? It is allowed to use a computer. And here in this, in Windows, for example, you have the programmer thing, and you say 103, 103, and it's binary representation is this, 1100111. Of course, the leading zeros do not count. So that's, of course, allowed. However, you can do it by hand by dividing successively by 2. So we say 103 divided by 2, that's 51, and the remainder is 1, okay? Then 51 divided by 2, that's 25, and the remainder is 1. 25 divided by 2, that's 12, the remainder is 1. 12 divided by 2, that's 6, the remainder is 0. 6 divided by 2 is 3, the remainder is 0. 3 divided by 2, that's 1, the remainder is 1. And 1 divided by 2, that's 0, and the remainder is 1, and you read the remainders backwards. So it's 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. So that's how you can do it, or you can do it by dividing by 16. And there is the modulus will be 4 bits each time. Then you raise to the power of 2 to the power of I. So wherever you have an asterisk, that's 1 in the binary representation of the exponent. And remember, the first row in the table is the LSB, least significant bit of this representation. It's this bit. It's this row, and this bit, it's last row. So the first one is always the base, in this case 47, and then just square. So 47 square modulo 143, that's 64, then square modulo 143, etc., etc. In the end, you multiply the elements that actually are labeled with the asterisk, so it will be 92 times 53 times 92 times 64 times 47. If this number is too large to fit in the calculator, then you can use this. Multiply 2 and then reduce modulo 143, and then multiply with the next one and reduce modulo 143, etc., etc. Then none of the results will be greater than 143. Okay, so what you get is 5, obviously, so this will be the message. So this is nice with small numbers, however, it's easy to break because the numbers are small, so factoring of n is easy. Now, of course, if you want to really use RSA in a production environment, there are many details how this can be efficiently implemented, and it has been done, so there is not much to investigate further in this setting. And besides, since everybody is talking about quantum computers, then the effort of all the cryptographers is concentrated on how to find solutions that would not be broken by means of a quantum computer. So like Lattice and all this. But that's the PhD course, not a master course. Now, we have noticed that in order to use RSA or discrete log or whatever, we need primes. And now we are going to find out how to test for primality. Of course, how do we get primes? We take a number at random, of course an odd one, because the only prime that is even is 2. So we take an odd number, and then we actually test somehow whether it is a prime. Okay, now the problem in computational theory of finding primes is like this. Given a number, is it a prime? Yes or no? We said that we only use yes-no versions of any problem, but this is yes-no by definition. So, given a number, is it prime? Now, it was not known whether it is in P until 2002, so that's relatively recently, but in 2002, these three authors from India, they actually proved that prime is in P, and that was a sensation at that time. So people believed that it was in P, but it was actually hard to prove. Okay? Now, its time complexity is polynomial in K, where K is the size of the integer in bits. Now, if you want to use this algorithm in practice, that will be hard, because it's actually not very efficient, even though it's bounded by a polynomial. But its significance is theoretical. That's also important. So in practice, what we do is probabilistic primality testing algorithms. So we test whether an algorithm is a prime by means of a probabilistic algorithm, which means the answer can be that it is a prime, but you are not 100% sure. So you have to try several times with different parameters. These are called probable primes. Okay, so you will have that this number is a prime with high probability. But there are also deterministic algorithms like this one, AKS. But there are other deterministic algorithms that produce what we call probable primes. So if you get the answer from this algorithm that it is a prime, then it is a prime. And no further testing is necessary. So we start with probable primes. The probable primes that are extremely large are not very easy to get. Because of that, they are not used for this. However, they are used in cryptography for other purposes, like when we want to use them in elliptic curve setting, etc., etc. So we can use them. So the algorithms, as the name says, they give explicit correct answer if the given integer is prime. They are in general less efficient, like this AKS, that's very inefficient. So they are less efficient than the algorithms generating probable primes, but the advantage of these are obvious because once you get the answer, you don't have to test further. And from a probabilistic algorithm, once you get the answer, if the answer is that the number is prime, then you have to try several times with different parameters to check. And still, the answer is always with certain probability. It can be 99.9999, but it's still not one. Because of that, these algorithms probable that give probable primes, they also have applications like in generating elliptic curves for cryptographic purposes. That's one of the cryptographic applications. Of course, in theory, you can use that if you can get a probable prime of certain size, you can use it in RSA as well, if it is 2,000 bits, but it will probably be difficult. The algorithms are obviously deterministic of this kind that give probable primes. For example, the AKS, Agrawal, Kayal, and Saxena, it works for all n, but it's not efficient enough to test large n, even though its time complexity is bounded by a polynomial. And there are special primes of certain form, like Mersenne primes. We have met them when we talked about stream ciphers. So the primes of the form 2 to the power of something minus 1. So these are called Mersenne primes, and they are relatively easy to check with a special algorithm, this Lucas-Lehmer algorithm. It's a very old algorithm. It's also a polynomial time algorithm. And the largest known primes that we know in general, they are actually of this form, 2 to the power of k minus 1, because they are relatively easy to test. And these are really big. So now, one of the theorems that has been used extensively in practice to generate probable primes is this Pocklington's theorem. It's more than 100 years old, and it has found application in cryptography. And then Maurer, he developed a test. And Maurer is he's very well known in the world of cryptography, the known name in cryptography, so with authority, etc., etc. So he used this Pocklington's theorem to generate primes that are useful for cryptography. So what do we test? We test whether the given integer is prime. Okay? So n, we don't know whether it is prime or not, so we want to check that. And we want to test by using this theorem, and you will see what it is. Now, to this end, we have to know a smaller integer f with a known factorization. So we can use a very small integer, and we shall surely know the factorization. However, then afterwards here we have a lot of things to check. So it would be nice if we would know a big integer that is smaller than n, whose factorization is known. Okay? This number, when we say factorization is known, it doesn't mean that it's not a prime. So it may be a prime as well. So we choose a big prime, and then that's simpler to implement. Then we factor f. And f is p1 to e1 times p2 to e2 times pr to er. So there are r factors, each of them of some multiplicity. And then we represent n as 2 times r times f plus 1, if possible. Okay? So we have to summarize. We have to find f in such a way that 2 times r times f plus 1 give n. Okay? Which means I have n, like say 23. Then I subtract 1, that's 22. I divide by 2, that's 11. Is 11 a prime? Yes, that's very good. Or if it is not a prime, do I know the factorization of that number? It's also good. Now, once we do that, then we try several so-called bases, B, and check whether this holds. B to the power of n minus 1 is congruent to 1 modulo n, and b to the power of n minus 1 divided by these factors, minus 1 and n, are mutually prime. In which case, if all this holds, then every prime factor of n has the form this. So we find the factors of n. And if we find the factors, that means that n is composite. But if not, then if f is greater than square root of n by Pocklington's theorem, which means f is odd and f is greater than r, then n is a prime. That's why we can use this theorem to test for primality. Now, this is more than 100 years old. Now, Maurer actually showed that we can use third root of n, not square root of n. That's better. So he improved somehow this theorem, and he applied that directly to generate so-called probable primes. So Maurer also showed that if n is prime, then finding the base b is relatively easy. There are small number of these b's. And if n is composite, unless n is of very special form, for almost every b, it will hold that it will not be 1, b to the power of n minus 1, so we just reject them. So this is Maurer's algorithm for finding primes, and these are probable primes. And here is an example. So as we said, 23. So 23, we have to check whether it is a prime. So we take 11, which is a prime, So its multiplicity is 1. So we have 2 times r times 11 plus 1. Is it 23? It is. It's very nice. Okay. Of course, we cannot just take any f, because it will not give 2 times f or 2r times f plus 1 given this number. But as we said, we do the other way around. We say 23 minus 1, that's 22, divide by 2 at least, that's 11. And then we can use this 11, because we know it's a prime. So for some numbers, it will be easy to check by means of this theorem. And then what remains is to try several b's. If you take 3 as a b, so we compute 3 to the power of 22, whether it is equal to 1 modulo 23, it is. So you can easily check. You use modular exponentiation. So as we said, we use it everywhere. And then, what is the factor? Factor of 11 is 11, no other factor. So we have 3 to the power of 22 divided by the factor, which is 11 minus 1 and 23. Are they mutually prime? They are. Is 11 greater than square root by Poklitnov's theorem of 23? It is. So 23 is a prime. So that's an interesting theorem that is more than 100 years old that has found application 100 years later in practice. How fast is this? Time complexity of this Maurer's algorithm that directly implements, more or less, it's just a cubic root here, not square root. The time complexity is k to the power of 4 divided by logarithm of k, where k is the size of n in bits. Now, if you take a probable prime generating algorithm like Miller-Rabin that is very often used, we are going to explain it, it's k to the power of 4. So it's not much slower than this one, than this one. So that's about probable primes. Probable primes are not so often used for RSA, because for RSA we need very, very big numbers. No? So it's difficult to use that there. In this case, we use probabilistic algorithms. They are faster than deterministic algorithms in general. The answer is correct if the output is composite. So the question is always the same. Given n, is it a prime? If such an algorithm gives you the answer, no, it's not a prime, it's a composite, okay, then it's true, okay? So you don't have to check further, but you're not interested in these numbers, you want primes. If it says that it is a prime, then you have to check further. So it's not 100% sure. Many primality tests for probable primes, they are based on this theorem, so-called Fermat's little theorem, that's from Middle Age. So if n is prime, and if b and m are mutually prime, then b to the power of n minus 1 is 1 modulo n. Okay, then we can try all b for which b and n are mutually prime, and check whether this holds. And that's called Fermat's primality test. What is the problem here? The problem is that this may hold for composite numbers as well. It's not very likely, but it happens. So if n is not prime and the expression holds, this expression, b to the power of n minus 1 congruent to 1 modulo n, then we call it pseudoprime in the base B. And here is an example, 91. 91 is 7 times 13, we know that. And 91 is not obviously a prime. Now, but if you check for B equal to 3, so 3 to the power of 90, is it congruent to 1 modulo 91? It is, actually. So you can try that. You can even try, I think it will fit 3 to the power of 90, that's a big number, but modulo 91, that's 1, you see. So it satisfies the Fermat's condition. However, we know that it's not a prime. So it's a pseudo prime. So we, if you try base 2, then we find that 2 to the power 90 is not 1. It's 64, so it's not a prime. So by trying several initial conditions of the test, in this case several bases, B, we check further once we get the answer that it is good number, so prime number. Now, actually, all these algorithms, the question is not given a number, is it a prime? The question is given a number, is it composite? And that's why they are called yes biased. Yes biased because the answer, if it is yes, then it's biased towards yes. So yes is true, so we don't have to check further. If the answer is no, then we have to check further. So all these algorithms are called yes biased because they are biased in this sense. So the answer yes to the question given n is it composite is true. So what would be Fermat primality test? It would be like this. Choose a random base between 1 and n minus 1. Test whether b to the power of n minus 1 is 1 modulo n. If it is, it is composite. So we don't have to check further. So n is bad. Okay. Now, if it is not true, which means if this is 1, then n is probably prime. And then we must check many bases to check that, to reduce the error probability. Because we have seen on a very small example that for 3 it's a prime, but for 2 it's not a prime. This 91. So as we said, Fermat test and many other tests, and we are going to see at least 2 today, additional tests, is a compositeness test. The answer n is composite is true, and we don't need a further check. So they are yes biased. Now the next test is most often used in practice, and that's Miller-Rabin primality test. It's relatively easy to implement. There is a paper in the doc section if you want proofs. So, given n greater than 1, of course, and odd, because otherwise it's not a prime, so write, well, unless it is 2, but 2 is a special case. Huh? Write n minus 1 as 2 to the power of k times m, where m is odd, which means take n minus 1 and divide by 2 as long as you can. Okay? And then choose a random integer a such that a is between 1 and n minus 1, and then compute b0 is a to m modulo n. Looks like Fermat's test. No? Now, if b0 is plus or minus 1 modulo n, then n is probably prime and the algorithm stops. Okay. Else, if not any of these, compute the next square. So b1 is square of b0, modulo n again. Now you can get 1, in which case n is composite. So you know that it is composite. And you get a factor, actually. b0 minus 1 and n, you run Euclidean algorithm, you get the common factor of these two. So you get a factor. If you are interested in factoring n, but usually you are not because you are testing n for primality. Now, if for b1 you get minus 1, then you stop. You say n is probably prime, but you have to check further. If not minus 1, and if not 1, then you square again. Okay? And then you can get 1, the same. N is composite. If you get minus 1, n is probably prime. So, if none of these two, then square again. But you will not square forever. You will square until you reach bk minus 1. And this k, if you remember, was this power here. So how many times you divide it by 2? Now, if for k, bk minus 1 is not minus 1, then n is definitely composite. So that's actually the Miller-Rabin primality test. And we have that program, and you will see that in action today in the exercise. This is very important because this one is very often almost always used in practice because it's relatively easy to implement. For example, 561, so easy to prime. So n minus 1 is 560, divide by k by 2 as we can, as long as we can. So divide by 2, etc., etc., we can do it 4 times. So 560 is 2 to the power of 4 times 35. So 35 is not divisible by 2 further. So this is our m. Okay? And k is 4. Then we choose at random some base, say 2. And we power. B0 is 2 to the power of m, 35, modulo 561, it's 263. So is it 1, is it minus 1, none of them. Then we have to square, 166. Square again, 67. Square again, 1. Okay, and this 3 is k minus 1, k was 4. So if it is 1, then it is composite. And you even get the factor. It's B2 minus 1. So you get a factor which is 33. Now, it's easy to do. So you just divide by 2 many several times, and then you square several times. Now, if A and N are such that N passes the Miller-Rabin test, it's called strong pseudoprime. So with Fermat it was called pseudoprime. With Miller-Rabin it's called strong pseudoprime. The probability that if it is says that it's not composite, it's not really composite. So if it's really a prime, is much higher than with Fermat. But that's for one base. How do we check? We change the base and run the algorithm again. And then change the base, run the algorithm again. How many times? Well, if you run 10 times, then the probability of error, which means probability of saying not composite, and that it is really composite, it's 1 in million. Okay, so, well, run it 100 times and you will be sure. And that's relatively easy to run. So 2 to the power of 560 is 1, modulo 561. That means that n is pseudo-prime in the base 2, strong. It's pseudo-prime. So it will pass, you see, this is Fermat here. So Fermat would say for the base 2, it is a prime. So we say it's pseudo-prime. But now we check with Miller-Rabin's test and we see that it's not a prime, so it's not a strong pseudo-prime in the base 2. So to further check, we change the base several times and we repeat the test. So that's what you always do with probabilistic algorithms. And now what we are going to explain is another probabilistic algorithm, Solovay-Strassen, but to understand this algorithm, we have to introduce the concept of quadratic residue, Legendre symbol, and Jacobi symbol. And these are used in many other applications, and because of that, we are going to introduce that and run. Solovay-Strassen is also used. So, if you want probable primes, you would do Miller-Rabin and Solovay-Strassen to be sure. So, several times. Because you are never sure. So n is big. So how can we be sure that its probability that it is a prime is very high. However, it's not 1. And we are actually never sure. It's a probabilistic result. So what is a quadratic residue? Well, the name says if P is an odd prime and A is an integer, A is a quadratic residue if it is a square modulo P. So if x squared is equal to a modulo p, in that case we say a belongs to this set qp, otherwise if it is not quadratic residue, it belongs to the set not qp. So how can we get quadratic residue? If we are given some group, for example, integers modulo 7, well, we square. 1 square is 1, 2 square is 4, 3 square is 2, so 9 modulo 7. 4 square is 2, 5 square is 4, and 6 square is 1. Okay, so what are quadratic residues? Well, 1, 2, and 4, so what you get here. So all the numbers that appear in this row, they are obtained by squaring. And since we have enumerated all the elements of the group, then we cannot have more of these. So 1, 2, and 4 are quadratic residues. So quadratic residue is something that we need later. How else we can do that? So this is not very efficient. You have to enumerate all the elements of the group. If P is large, then it will take a long time. Now, another way, if P is an odd prime and alpha is a generator of ZP times, then A is a quadratic residue if and only if A is alpha to some degree, to some power modulo P, where I is even, 0, 2, 4, etc., until P minus 3. So we actually reduce the number of checks by this. But we need a generator of the group. So in this case, 3, we know that it's a generator by trial and error. So you just try to get all the elements by powering 3. Well, what are even numbers smaller than 7? 0, 2, and 4, 6 doesn't count, so until P minus 3. And then 3 to I modulo 7. I is 0, 2, or 4, so it will be 1, 2, and 4. So we get our quadratic residues by means of a smaller number of checks. And then Euler's criterion. If P is prime, then this holds. A to the power A is a quadratic residue if and only if, which means both sides. A to P minus 1 divided by 2 is 1 modulo P. Okay? So P is a prime. And how many quadratic residues are there? P minus 1 divided by 2. And this is called Euler's criterion. For example, for the same group, P equal to 7, P minus 1 divided by 2 is 3. So how many quadratic residues? 3. And then if we try all, x to 3 modulo 7. P minus 1 is 6 divided by 2 is 3, so we have to try all these possible powers to P minus 1 divided by 2. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and we get 1, 1, 6, 1, 6, 6. So those where we have 1, they are quadratic residues. So it's 1, 2, and 4 again. So we have seen that in many ways we can get quadratic residues, and this one is practical because we don't have actually to compute much. If you just want to check one base, you just check this expression. The next concept that we introduce is the Legendre symbol, and this Legendre symbol is not so important for our testing, but it is a base for defining Jacobi symbol, which is the extension of the Legendre symbol that is actually used in our algorithm for generating probable primes. To compute the Legendre symbol, we need actually factorization. That's why it's not very useful, because usually we don't know the factorization. However, we assume that we do know. So if P is an odd prime, for any integer A, we define this Legendre symbol, how can we call it, A over P or something like that, in this way. A over P is 0 if P divides A. It is 1 if A is a quadratic residue. And it is minus 1 if A is not a quadratic residue. How do we check whether A is a quadratic residue? We use Euler's criterion. So by Euler's criterion, A to the power of P minus 1 divided by 2 is 1 modulo P if and only if A is quadratic residue. If A is a multiple of P, it's obvious that it is zero. Why? Because A can be written as K times P. And then to the power of whatever, if you take modulo P, then you get zero. And it can be shown, we are not getting into that, that if it is minus 1, then it's not in quadratic residue. So, how do we compute the Legendre symbol? A over P is A to P minus 1 divided by 2 modulo P. So it's either 0 or 1 or minus 1. Then Jacobi symbol, something that we actually need. But for that, we need the factorization of N. So here we had, in the Legendre symbol case, we had a P. It's a prime. And Jacobi symbol, N is not a prime. N is composite in general. That's the difference. So A over N, what is A over N? It's product of Legendre symbols, you see. A over PI to the power of EI, where EI is the multiplicity of the prime factor. So, if you know the factorization of N, then it's easy to compute Jacobi symbol. However, what you don't know is the factorization of N. It's usually assumed, because N is very large. Here is an example. If you know the factorization of N, I suggest that we continue without a break and then we stop earlier, okay? Because there are not many slides to go. So given that 9975 is this, 3 times 5 squared times 7 times 19, that's easy to get this way, because this number is relatively small. How do we evaluate Jacobi symbol, say, 6278 over 9975? So this is N. 9975 is N, 6278 is A. Well, we factor. 9975, we have found that, so by this formula, you see, the multiplicity matters. In our case, we have just one factor of multiplicity 2. So it will be 6278 over 3 times 6278 over 5 squared, because 5 is of multiplicity 2, times 6278 over 7 times 6278 over 19. How do we compute each of them? By using Euler's criterion. So it's A to P minus 1 divided by 2. Okay? So it's 6278 to the power of 19 minus 1 divided by 2, in this case, for example. And you get these numbers. Minus 1, that's this one. Minus 1, this one, but square. Minus 1, this one, and minus 1, this one. You can check that at home, but that's easy. You do it by means of a calculator for such small numbers. And this squared is 1, and we have 3 minus 1s, so we have minus 1. So that's our Jacobi symbol. Now, that's if we know the factorization of N, which we usually don't. What to do in that case? We use a couple of theorems that we consider rules. And we use these rules in a very specific order, as you're going to see, to reduce the size of our numbers until we get 0, 1, or minus 1. And you will see that's a relatively straightforward calculation. But there are several theorems. So N is an odd positive integer, and A and B are positive. Then these identities hold. The first one is 0 over N. What is 0 over N? If N is 1, it is 1. If N is greater than 1, it is 0. So we don't get into proofs, but that's one of these identities. The second one, 2 over N, that's very often used. It is 1 if N is plus or minus 1 modulo 8. Interesting, but there is a proof, so we use it as a fact. Or minus 1 if N is plus or minus 3 modulo 8. So whatever N, we just are interested in taking N modulo 8. Okay? And we get 2 over N. Then if A is congruent to B modulo N, then A over N is the same as B over N. That's used to reduce the size of the initial A. And if we want AB over N, so if we know the factors here, then it is A of N times B of N, B over N, A over N times B over N. Finally, this is very important, this quadratic reciprocity, and why is that? Because usually we have this number smaller than this number, okay? And because of that, we cannot use directly this rule. But we can switch between A over N and N over A by using this quadratic reciprocity theorem or rule by Gauss. So it's 300 years old. So if A is odd, then A over N is either minus N over A if A and N are congruent to 3 modulo 4, or it is N over A otherwise. So what we do is, using these 5 rules, we start from big numbers and we get into 0 or 1. To evaluate Jacobi symbol if we don't know the factors of N, which is usually the case. And here is an example. Suppose we want 7411 over 9283. I have no idea whether 9283 is a prime. We can check it. It is a small number. However, we don't want it this way. We want to compute Jacobi symbol by using the rules. So this number is smaller than this number. 7411 is smaller than 9283. Because of that, we first use the rule number 5, this one. So we actually check whether A is congruent to 3 modulo 4 and N is congruent to 3 modulo 4. Okay? So it depends whether this is minus or not a minus. So we say that's easy, actually. We compute 9283 modulo 4. That's 3. And we compute this one, 7411 modulo 4. That's also 3. Because of that, in our quadratic reciprocity theory, we have a minus here. So A over N is minus N over A in our case. So it's minus 9283 over 7411. But now, we can use the rule number 3, and that's good, because we reduce this number here. So we can reduce modulo B. So we can say that this number here, we can reduce modulo 7411, you see? So we say 9283 modulo 7411. That's 1872, you see? So this here is equivalent to this here. So 1872 over 7411, but this minus is from before. Now, we observed that it is an even number, you see? So we can use the rule number 4. The rule number 4 is this. A times B is over N is A over N times B over N. Okay? So we say this 1872 is 2 times 900 and something, but we can divide many times. You see that this is the power of 4 here. It's not the rule number 4. You may be confused, but this is the power. Because 1872, we can divide it by 2, actually 4 times. So 2 times, 3 times, and 4 times. So it's 117. So we can say it's 2 over 7411 4 times. So that means this to the power of 4, and times 117 over 7411. Now what is 2 over 7411? We can use the rule number 2. 2 over n is 1 if n is plus or minus 1 modulo 8. Okay, so what is n? N is 7411. What is 7411 modulo 8? That's 3, you see. So if it is 3, so we say that this 2 over is actually plus 1, you see. Otherwise, it's 3, it's minus 1, sorry. It's minus 1. So each of them is minus 1, but since it is to the power of 4, then it is plus 1. So this part here, together with the power, is plus 1. This minus is this minus here, so it remains. And this remains, 117 over 7411. So what we have is, after the first cycle of using our rules, we get minus 117 over 7411. So we have smaller numbers here, which is good, but we still have this number smaller than this one. So we repeat the procedure. So we use the rule number 5, and then the rule number 3, and then the rule number 4, and then, if possible, the rule number 2. So we do that until we get, you see, until either we get here a prime, then it's a Legendre symbol. In our case, we have obtained. Or we get very small number, or directly by means of these rules, we get plus or minus 1. So in our case, 2 over 5 is, we can even use the rule number 2, it's minus 1. Because 5 modulo 8, that's minus 3. So we successively applied identities 5, 3, 4, and 2 from the theorem. Sometimes we get a 0, then that's a rule number 1. Rarely. Now, once we know this, we can define the Solovay-Strassen algorithm. It's also called yes-biased Monte Carlo algorithm, because the question is, given n, is it composite? If the algorithm says yes, then it is composite, it's biased towards yes. If it says no, then we have to change the initial conditions and try again, and if we all the time get that it is not composite, then it's probably a prime. So that's Solovay-Strassen algorithm. So yes answer is always correct, no answer may be incorrect. Now what do we need for Solovay-Strassen? If n is prime, we use the Euler's theorem. So we have a over n is a to the power of n minus 1 divided by 2 modulo n. So why? Because this is a Legendre symbol. You see, if n is prime. So if n is prime, we get this. Now, if n is composite, we compute the same thing. This may be true. If it is true, the answer will be no from the algorithm. It is not composite, but it may not be true. So such a number is called Euler pseudoprime. So how do we do this? We use Jacobi symbol in this algorithm, that's called Solovay-Strassen, and it's like this. Repeat k times, we repeat many times, like 100 times. Choose a random integer a such that a is between 1 and n, and compute a over n. You see, a over n by means of this other formula. So a to the power of n minus 1 divided by 2. Now, if we get 0, then we know that it's composite. This will probably not happen, so small probability for that. Now, the next thing that we do is compute Euler's formula. And here, how do we compute this? This is, if we assume that n is not a prime, then we use Jacobi symbol. So this is Jacobi symbol. And here, this is Legendre symbol. If we get that these two things are the same, x and y, then it's probably prime, but not 100%. So if x is equal to y modulo n, then n is prime. That will be the answer. But the error can be 50%. Now, if we said that, if we notice that x is not equal to y, then we know that it is composite. Okay? Say that n is 9283 and a is 7411. So that is our example that we used before. You see, so we have computed the Jacobi symbol. It is minus 1. So that's this x. Okay? And then Legendre we compute by powering. So x is minus 1, we have already done that. So that's Jacobi symbol. And we can power, use modular exponentiation, because this power is pretty big, so it will not fit in calculator. And for homework, just to practice, do this. So we will get that it is minus 1. So minus 1 equal to minus 1, the output is that it is not composite. So the output will be that n is a prime. But it might not be true. Yeah. So the probability that 9283 is really a prime is greater than 50%, but it's far from 100%. So we have to choose another A, and then choose another A. That's why we say repeat k times. Yeah. So with different values for A, n is given. So usually you set k equal to 100 to reduce the chance of getting a wrong answer. So getting that it is a prime when it is really a composite number. So that would be Solovay-Strassen. So that would be how to get primes in probabilistic way, in deterministic way, and that's what we need for RSA, we need for El-Gamal, we need for everything. So primes are very on demand. Okay, so we are done for today's lecture, and in the afternoon, after the lunch break, we practice this. Thank you.